Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is this year's winner of the Ann V. Zero Award for Young Readers Literature, Laurie Haltz Anderson. Anderson is the author of over 18 books of fiction and nonfiction for young readers, from picture books to young adult novels that address mature subjects ranging from PTSD's effects on family to anorexia and sexual assault. A former journalist, her first book, a picture book titled Nadito's Run, was based on news stories on Kenyan marathon runners who train by running back and forth to school each day. Her first young adult novel, Speak, was a New York Times bestseller and a finalist for the National Book Award. It was later adapted into a motion picture starring Kristen Stewart. Her Seeds of America trilogy, following the story of an escaped slave through the Revolutionary War, the first book, Chains, was also a National Book Award finalist. The two other books, Forge and the recently released Ashes, were also highly acclaimed. Winter Girls, a book that depicted eating disorders, was selected as an ALA Best Book. And the ALA, American Library Association, also awarded her the Margaret Edwards Award for Lasting Achievements in Young Readers Literature. Anderson will receive the Zero Award Friday evening at 7 at the Hardesty Regional Library in a free program. She'll be speaking about her life and works and award the winner of the library's Young People's Creative Writing Contest as well. Laurie Haltz Anderson is my guest today. Laurie Haltz Anderson, a welcome to Studio Tulsa. Congratulations on the Zero Award.
Thank you so much. I am deeply honored to be a part of this.
Well, it is really a who's who of writers for young people, and certainly you are very deserving of the award. And I want to ask you about your most recent completed book, Ashes. It's part of a trilogy of books set around the Revolutionary War, but from a very unique perspective, that of escaped slaves fighting in the war and surrounding the war. How did this idea, did you just want to write about the Revolutionary War? Did you want to write about African-Americans coming here? And what was exactly the impetus for the trilogy?
Well, you know, my own family is a New Englander family, Yankees, who some of them came over on the Mayflower. And I have about two dozen relatives that I know of who fought for the Patriots during the American Revolution. And I was raised and still am very patriotic. I love this country. We have a magnificent thing going on here, this experiment in democracy. So I've always been fascinated by American history. And then about 25 years ago, I was researching another historical novel, Fever 1793. And in the course of that research, I found out that Benjamin Franklin, one of my big heroes, had held people in slavery. And that so overturned everything I thought I understood about American history. I'd never heard of slavery in the North before. So 25 years ago, I began researching that slavery in the North, slavery during the time of the colonial time period and the American Revolution. And I discovered that the story of our revolution is so much broader and more significant than I think most of us realize. Yes, of course, there are the amazing actions of the founding fathers, George Washington, Franklin, Alexander Hamilton. But there are a lot of other Americans whose stories we don't know about very much, who were every bit as important to our victory and our freedom.
So where did you begin your research about this particular story, about these two sisters, Isabel and Ruth, mm-hmm. who were sold into slavery, come to New York? Well, they're expected to receive their freedom, but in fact they're sold to a Tory sympathizer. And from there, the story takes off in these three books.
Precisely. One of the things looking at the body of children's literature and what novels had already been written about the American Revolution, I realized that so often with our children we emphasize the early events of the war, which is Boston in 1775. We just had, for example, last week, the anniversary of the Battle of Lexington and Concord. The most famous book in children's literature, Johnny Tremaine, ends in 1775 as the war is beginning. So I wanted to look at what happens after the Patriots and the British Army leave Boston, which is why I set the first book of the trilogy, Chains, in New York City. It's the summer of 1776, which is a very dramatic time. You have the Patriot Army occupying for the summertime, and then there's the Declaration of Independence, and then the British Army shows up 30,000 strong in New York Harbor. When you're writing books for kids, you always want to make sure that they're interested. And when you have stakes that are that high, something's happening on every page.
you're getting into the sort of Johnny Tremaine territory. I've talked to a number of teachers. You know, I remember when I was growing up, Johnny Tremaine was just it as far as this particular historical era of historical novel. They said teachers, they can't get their kids interested in Johnny Tremaine now. And I'm wondering do you think tastes have changed, or is it something about the way you tell the story that gets kids interested in this era?
Well, I think that Johnny Tremaine, for its day, I believe it was written in 1942,
right,
was an outstanding piece of literature. But there are a lot of books that were very popular in 1942 that we don't read today.
That's true.
Times change. People's tastes change. Also, our understanding of the history of the time period has changed, too. Johnny Tremaine, Esther Forbes, who is the author of that book, very talented woman. But historians have done so much work since the early 40s, late 30s, that we have a much deeper understanding of the war. And some of the facts that she portrays would not probably pass the smell test today. Mm. So that could be a part of it. And I think the bar for the quality of children's literature is certainly as high right now as it has ever been. And this is why I'm so proud to be a children's author, and why whenever I look at the list of other authors who've been graced with a Zero Award, I kind of gasp, you know? but because nothing is more important to my mind than telling great stories to children, because that's how we turn children into literate Americans.
Take me back to the beginning of your writing career. Were you always a writer? I know you pursued a degree in linguistics, I believe. Was writing always a part of your life? Was it writing novels? Was it writing short stories? When did you come upon young readers' literature as your pathway?
Well, first of all, I had to learn to love reading, and that took me a little bit longer than other kids. I have to give all the credit to my career and probably my life as an adult to the reading support teachers in the Syracuse City School Districts in Syracuse, New York, because they turned me into reader. It took me longer, because I had some comprehension issues. When I finally did learn how to read, though, I became that kid who was always in the library. I read actually literally walking to school and walking home. But it didn't occur to me that I wanted to become a writer until after college. I guess maybe because those early days of being such a poor reader and being such a poor writer kind of scarred me. But I wound up after college falling into journalism. And I worked for local newspapers and then the Philadelphia Inquirer. And then as I became a mother to my own young children, I read a lot of picture books with them from the library, and I went, huh, I wonder if I could do this kind of writing too. And it took me several hundred rejection letters to learn how to do that well. But I have to say my kids also get some of the credit for this career, because I started writing for them.
So you started out writing picture books. I think one of your very first books was based on an NPR story, right?
It was
inspired.
Oh, I'm so glad you know that. That's exciting to me. Yes, it was one morning when I was staying in bed a little bit too long listening to Morning Edition. And I probably had wanted to get up to go jogging, because that's one of my favorite things to do. And a great story came on with a reporter who was, this is back in the early 90s, reporting on the then phenomena of the Kenyan runners. Why is it that Kenya produces the absolute highest quality long-distance runners in the world? And this reporter went out and went jogging a bit with some of the children from these villages that he was reporting from, and I could hear the sound of the girls laughing, because he wasn't very fast, and they were. And you could hear the reporter gasping for air. It's like one of those great sound stories,
right,
that NPR is so good at creating. And when I heard the sound of those young girls laughing, I wanted to understand their lives better. So I wrote a book about them.
Yeah. You wrote a number of picture books and then sort of moved into young adult fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And the art of a good picture book, I mean, the art of writing the story of a good picture book, this story has to be boiled down to its essence, to a few sentences on a page. I would think that would be really good practice,
just in
the essence of writing.
You've nailed it. If I was ever going to teach a course on the novel, I would start out with 8 weeks of picture book writing. because it is story at its most elemental. It's the bones of the story. None of that fancy pants language that you get to play with, because that's all taken care of with the art. You have to understand, what are your conflicts, who is your character, and what is the character battling? So picture books are a lovely place to start.
Do you think it's a good place to start? Or I would think, since you started out, you know, writing them and publishing, I think it would be really immensely difficult to get that down.
No, I actually think it was helpful, because I can remember when I started writing, thank goodness my kids were young, so I was only thinking about picture books. And at the time, the thought of a novel was so intimidating. And I think that's very common, you know, 300 pages. I can't write 300 pages. So I also think for, you know, someone at the beginning of their writing career, maybe starting with the idea of a picture book, it's simpler and less intimidating.
Hmm. Of course, journalism probably helps in that too, writing for print, because it's all about telling the story as quickly and as succinctly as possible too.
I think that's part of why I wound up writing books for children. One of my favorite critiques came from a boy in high school once who said, "Miss, I liked your books because you don't waste a lot of time describing sunsets." Out of the mouth of babes.
Now, that could kind of hurt too, though. I mean, because I'm sure a good writer always wants to put a little descriptive juice in there.
Only, and this is like probably the best piece of writing advice I can give everybody. Your writing has to always be in concert with the goals of the story. And if you want to describe the sunset, there had better be a good reason we need that sunset description.
My guest today is Laurie Hulse Anderson, a young adult and children's writer and the winner of the Ann Vizero Award for Young Readers Literature. She'll receive the award and present awards to the Young People's Creative Writing Contest Friday at 7 o'clock at the Hardesty Regional Library. So I want to go back to your most recent young adult novel prior to the trilogy, and that was The Impossible Knife of Memory. And this was a story about a really remarkable heroine in the book, who, like a lot of kids, is forced to grow up early. And I think that's one of the most interesting themes that you'll see in young adult novels, is this idea of having to grow up early. In the case of this heroine, her father is really struggling with PTSD from his wartime experiences. And in many cases, she's having to be the parent of the relationship, and meanwhile trying to negotiate her own life. What was the inspiration for this particular book, The Impossible Knife of Memory?
It was a combination of my own experience with my father and then watching my nephew come home from war. My father was a World War II veteran who got to Germany in 1945, having been a country boy in northern New York up near Canada. And his unit got to the Dachau concentration camps shortly after it opened. They weren't the liberating units, but they followed right behind them. What my father saw there in Dachau never left him. It's what led him to become a minister, United Methodist minister. And it's what led him to try to live a life that was anchored in love, because he'd seen what hatred could do. But the scars never left him either, and the gentlemen from that generation got no treatment for their PTSD. And like so many fellows, my dad tried to bottle up his feelings and wound up crawling into a bottle sometimes. So his alcoholism was a big part of my childhood, and he definitely had some years when he was emotionally broken and absent, which is not to say that I didn't love him. I adored my dad. He was the most important person in my young life. And so that experience of having a parent that you love and respect and are afraid for and are sometimes afraid of was very personal to me. But I didn't really think about that in terms of a story until my nephew came back from his tours of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I, you know, followed him and tried to help him renegotiate civilian society and found a whole new generation of soldiers, men and women, returning to their country and their families battered in ways you could see, sometimes in ways you couldn't. And I realized, oh my goodness, we've got a whole new generation of kids who are going to grow up with what I grew up with. And I wanted to tell that story.
It's hard. It is truly hard when you, especially if you knew your nephew before he he right. left. And it's like two different people, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And to be the 10-year-old, you know, who's been waiting eagerly for that mom or dad to come home, and then it's not the mom or dad who left. Or for parents, you know, whose son or daughter comes home, and it's, you know, there are so many things I can get frustrated about when it comes to the way our government and democracy is working today, but our treatment of veterans and their families is almost probably got to be at the top of the list, because mm-hmm. we ask these good-hearted, generous Americans to sacrifice so much, and then we don't honor that sacrifice.
No. I mean, we'll give them a parade, but as far as giving them the necessary tools to deal with everything they experience.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. It's horrifying.
Well, in the case of Haley Kincaid, the heroine, you've given her an unusual, I mean, she's had this crazy upbringing, because she was literally out of school, being sort of homeschooled by her father on the road for a number of years, and she settles down for her senior year in one place, back in her father's hometown. What was special about giving her this very different experience than most kids would have?
Well, part of that was me thinking about the classic veteran story in Western literature, which is the Odyssey, right? It's the soldier who comes home from war but doesn't go directly home.
Right.
All right? And I think that to me, and I've read some other smarter thinkers, this is not an original idea on my part at all, I borrowed it.
Right.
But who kind of look at that as a metaphor for the fact that it takes time after a war experience for a soldier to reconcile the war self with the peace self and to really come home, to come home in spirit as well as in body. So, and I felt that having Haley, her father's a long-distance trucker before the book opens, and to have her on the road with him, that's what you do when you have PTSD, post-traumatic. You're not at home yet. And the always moving and the need to not let yourself think too much, and you just keep running until you run out of room.
And this has affected Haley tremendously. I mean, she is there's this one little situation where she meets a young man, and I love the way how you wrote this. It's like she said, you know, she was absent knowing anything about, quote, the rules, capital T, capital R, this whole code of how you're supposed to behave to members of the opposite sex in high school. I thought it was very, very charming. Why give her this sort of outsider role?
I wanted to, first of all, let's make clear that this book is narrated by Haley,
yeah.
right? So we have an unreliable narrator. I believe that all first-person narrators are unreliable because they can only, you know, we're experiencing the book through them, but we don't understand at the beginning of the book what their perceptive filters are. And I thought having two things. First of all, I needed something in the book that was going to be uplifting, because just a teenager having to cope with a parent with PTSD is going to be the most depressing book ever. And teenagers, one of the glories about being an adolescent is that no matter how hard times are, you can generally find some kind of ray of sunlight to keep you going. And that was originally my thought for the relationship with this young boy, who's very sweet, is that, you know, he's falling in love with her, and he's interested. And so he wound up being a good balance to the darker aspects of her life. But also, later in the writing process, I realized that we needed to have that, because this is the most terrible lesson of adolescence, is when you realize that you can never fix another human being. Right? That's something we all have to come to terms with over the course of our lives. And when you've been trying, as a kid who's in a family dealing with trauma, when you've been trying to fix your parent who's dealing with mental illness, that realization is the most painful one that you'll probably ever have. So she needs to have somebody in her life that gives her a respite, you know, a chance to breathe from the difficulties of the relationship with her father.
Yeah. I also love the fact that you said, you know, Odyssey was an inspiration, And you have this little reference to the Odyssey in the book.
Yeah, you know.
And also, I think you actually, in one of the classes, they talk about an unreliable narrator, if I'm not mistaken. I might have misread that. But
No, I think you got that one, too.
Yeah, exactly. Is that just having fun with the reader?
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. That's exactly what it is, yep.
My guest today is Laurie Hulse Anderson, a young adult and children's writer, winner of the Anne Vizero Award for Young Readers Literature. She'll receive the award and present awards to the Young People's Creative Writing Contest winners here in the Tulsa area Friday at 7 at Hardesty Regional Library. The Vizero Award used to be awarded at the end of the summer. Now they're doing it at the beginning of the summer in early May. And so she's our winner and our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, one of the things that's happened during the course of your writing young adult novels is this explosion in this genre. Why do you account for why even adults, instead of picking up what we used to think as beach reads, they're oftentimes picking up young adult novels to spend time at the beach or for just everyday pleasure reading?
I think in the beginning of this, it started, as far as I know, in the late 80s. It was because, I'm of the baby boom generation, tail end of it, and our generation had a lot of kids at once, right? And so there's this demographic of, I remember going to school board meetings when my kids were in elementary school, and the poor school board members were frantic having to build elementary schools as fast as they could, because we all had babies at the same time. So that's a beautiful thing, but also brings with it a need for schools and for a body of literature. Some incredibly robust literature has come out of the last 30 years. And I think what happened is, one of the reasons that I transitioned from picture books to historical fiction and then to young adult fiction is that my own children were growing up. My first YA novel, Speak, was written because I watched my oldest daughter, who's now a librarian, but I watched her enter middle school, and that triggered me into thinking about the adolescent transitions. And I think that there were a lot of other writers in the same boat that I was in. So we had, in 1999, the year Speak came out, was the first year that the American Library Association recognized YA literature with its own award called the Prince Award, which is like the Newbery mm-hmm. Book for teenagers. Mm-hmm. And what's happened since then is you have two things going on. First of all, everybody who was in high school in the late 90s has continued to read YA fiction into their 30s and in some cases their 40s, and then other generations are picking up on how wonderful this is too. I have one theory that I've never heard other people talk about, and I think it's because the challenges that we face or we fail to face when we're all teenagers, they tend to linger, especially the ones that maybe you weren't successful with.
Right, your failures, yeah.
Exactly, and we all know adults for whom life just, something went wrong in their adolescence, and they've never been able to get clear of that, get free of it. I get so much mail from adults, like adults even in their 60s and 70s sometimes, who connected with something that I wrote in a book for teenagers because it helped them in some way. Sometimes it helped them deal with their own old painful stuff, or they write because it gave them insight into another person or somebody in their family. And it's, our standards in children's literature are very, very high. We know that our intended audience, which is children and teenagers, they have a lot of choices when it comes to how they spend their time. So I think we're all really dedicated to trying to create exciting, engaging literature. So the quality is pretty darn good. And adults have figured that out too.
Do you think it's also the directness of the genre? Because, and at least in your stories, and most young adult novels, I mean, it's about plot, action, moving. Mm-hmm. And a lot of adult fiction today is now on slowing way down. You can write a mystery or a mm-hmm. thriller or something like that. That's different. But mm-hmm. but fiction, what we consider literary fiction, yeah, is about moving very slowly.
Yeah, it's interesting because I think within children's literature, which is a very broad term, you have more literary pieces that might move a little bit slower because the focus is a kind of small stage focus. And then you mm-hmm. have... You also have other subgenres, some of which are really fast-paced. Maybe it's because, I don't know, that's a really, you should get somebody on here who's like a professor of children's literature to get a good oversight. From my corner, I just think it's because people who write books for kids are really good storytellers.
Were you surprised the first time you started getting letters from adults reading your books?
Shocked.
Yeah.
Shocked. Mm-hmm. Never expected that in a million years.
Yeah. So you just finished, it's been a couple of years now since you actually finished the third book of the trilogy, mm-hmm. On the Revolutionary War. What are you working on these days? Is it a new novel, or are you still doing picture books and really young children's books in between your young adult novels, or is it pretty much young adult novels now?
The answers are yes and yes, yes and yes and yes. In February, the graphic novel version of Speak will be coming out,
mm-hmm.
and I did the adaptation for that, so I'm really excited, and I wait till the world sees the art. I'm super excited about that. This morning, before we chatted, I was working on a picture book that I'm working on about George Washington. I'm also doing a nonfiction companion book for my trilogy because a lot of people are stunned to learn about slavery during the time period of the Revolution. So I'm going to do a nonfiction book to help people understand that a little bit better. And I'm working on a YA novel.
When you say people are stunned to know that slavery was going on, I mean, slavery was... Even in the North, it wasn't abolished until early 19th century. Do you think it's just unknown? It's just thought of when you think of slavery, you think of the Deep South?
I think that is how we teach slavery in the United States. Is a particular, you know, we teach it through the lens of the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Because especially if you're up North, you teach it through the lens of the Civil War. You say, okay, we had slavery that was terrible. But then we had the war, and the North won. Yay for the North. And now it's all gone, which is a really whitewashed way of looking at the problem, and really disrespectful to the millions of American families who suffered from slavery. And it also completely takes away any possibility of a conversation about the social injustices that Americans struggle from today and how that's connected to those old attitudes. I think white people, and I number myself among them, often struggle to talk about slavery because we're not educated in it, many of us. And as I said earlier, I care so much about this country and our country people. I want us to have the language so that we can begin to talk about how did we get here, what about our founding documents, all people created equal, you know, all entitled to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, have we made possible for our sisters and brother Americans? And what do we still need to fix?
Well, we wish you great success in that journey that continues with your nonfiction book and what comes next for young adults. And congratulations on the Zara Award. Lauren?
Thank you so much.
Thanks,
Rich,
for joining.
I can't wait to get to Tulsa.
Lori Holtz Anderson is the winner of the Ann V. Zara Award for Young Readers Library, given by the Tulsa Library Trust. She'll be speaking about her life and works and award the winner of the library's Young People's Creative Writing Contest, as well as receiving the Zara Award, this Friday evening at 7 at the Hardesty Regional Library in a program that's free and open to the public. More information at tulsalibrary.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.